Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
Our tour through each team of the celebrated All-American Football Conference continues as in this edition we go in depth into the San Francisco 49ers AAFC franchise with the team's official historian, Joe Heschen. And we have Joe's details on the Niners and the AAFC coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And we have a really exciting trip we're going to take in this episode because we're going to stay in that mind frame of early pro football. And it's not real early like we've done in other episodes, but lately we've been talking a lot about the All-American Football Conference. And we're going to stay to that theme today and talk about another one of the great teams that came out of that very interesting four-year-old league, and that would be the San Francisco 49ers. And we have a great expert, Joe Heschen, that's going to join us from out that way today, and we'll bring him in right now. Joe Heschen, welcome to the Pigpen.
Hey, thanks for having me, Darren. Should be fun. Looking forward to it.
Yeah, this is an exciting team. Now, we don't get to talk in early football too much about the California teams because they're just sort of starting to make their way into the major leagues of pro football. And we're excited to talk about that. So I know you are quite the historian, especially the San Francisco 49ers. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do and how your interest came in the 49ers.
Well, right now I'm the 49ers team historian. Basically, I had worked as a sports reporter locally, done some stories on them. And even though sports wasn't my original journalistic area, but anyway, so I got into the 49ers stuff. And then in the 80s, I wrote a book on them. And then when they were putting together the new stadium down at Levi's Stadium, they contacted me and said, we're going to put it in a big Hall of Fame and museum, and we'd like you to, you know, do some of the work for it. So initially I just thought, okay, it's maybe like a closet full of stuff. And, you know, this ball was caught by Dwight Clark or whatever. And it turned into about a 2-year project. And there was just thousands of artifacts. And then they decided to put in a whole computer system so that people can log in on computers and there's interactive stuff. So I said, oh, that's great. And they go, yeah, but you got to write the information that goes on the computer. So it took a long time to do. What I thought was going to be like a 1-month project turned out to be a long time thing. And then they just asked me to stay on as the team historian. I had been a teacher. I taught for 30 years. And so I was ready to retire from teaching anyway. So this is a good retirement job.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good gig to me, and I'm sure to the listeners too. You get to think about football history each and every day, and you get paid for it. Wow, that's, you know, that's fantastic, yeah. Especially with a really brilliant franchise like the 49ers. And we're going to be really focusing in. I mean, they've got some exciting history for sure, and we'll talk about that in another episode. But we're really going to focus in on those AAFC years and maybe the origins of the team. So maybe you could talk a little bit about, we know that, you know, the Cleveland Rams moved about this time, 1946, in the NFL, and, you know, the AAFC was kicking in 46, but what was the football landscape up in the Bay Area before the 49ers joined into the AAFC?
Well, San Francisco was a big college football area. We had Cal, Stanford, San Jose State was pretty good back then, St. Mary's, Santa Clara, USF. They were all pretty good teams. And then most of them would kind of fight to play at Kezar Stadium for big games. Like in the old days, USF playing Santa Clara would have 50,000 people. But so it was mostly a college town for football. The original owner of the 49ers is a guy named Tony Morabito, and he tried to get an NFL franchise. So in about 1941 or two, he was trying to get into the NFL, but they wouldn't have him because, you know, the West flight to the West Coast was going to cost too much for all the teams on the East Coast. And they really thought that San Francisco was a college football town. So he couldn't get his NFL dream going. And about the mid-40s, I guess it was 1944 when they had their one of their first meetings for the All-America Football Conference, and he got in on that. So he got a team with the All-America Football Conference. He was still hoping he'd get in the NFL someday. So he was with a couple of other Los Angeles had a team too. So there was two West Coast teams for the All-America Football Conference, and you know, they started in 1946. So that's how they kind of got off the ground. And Tony Morabito was a local guy. It's interesting how, you know, when you look back at the team, how it's just like a homegrown team. Everybody was from local colleges, or they were coming home from the World War II, veterans coming back to San Francisco. Morabito obviously grew up in San Francisco. Their first coach was Buck Shaw. He coached at Santa Clara and brought a bunch of his old players back for the first team. And then, they recruited their first staff. It's kind of funny because all the first staff was all people that he just hired from his neighborhood. A woman that could type, a friend who he knew just got out of the Navy, became like the assistant general manager. So it was all just friends. And then, in that first year, the club had mostly returning World War II vets, and then they had either connection to the area because they went to school like Stanford or Santa Clara, or they, you know, got out of the service in San Francisco and liked it and stayed there. So it was a pretty interesting group. You know, you see guys from like 30 years old who had been in the service and then got out and started playing professional football, and guys that were just, like 21 or 22 year old right out of college. So it was kind of a wild mix of guys.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. World War II is a very interesting time for a lot of reasons, but from a football aspect, it seems like there is a lot of great athletes really honed their skills playing, you know, for their teams on their base or their camp teams, or, you know, some of the organized football that the military had to keep the guys in shape. And it's interesting how many great athletes came out of that, you know, maybe were subpar college, or maybe didn't even play college, and they came out and they became a professional. So that's kind of interesting. And AAFC gave them another opportunity to take it to the next level, having some extra teams to go to.
Yeah, we've gone through the original roster, like 30, I think there was 35 guys on the original roster. A couple guys got hurt along the way, but we figured out that 90% of them were returning veterans from World War II. I think guys with like Silver Stars, one couple of them got hurt in battle. One guy, you know, had shrapnel go through his back. Frankie Albert, the first quarterback, he was a Navy commander. Alan Beals, who was their great receiver at that time, he was at the Battle of the Bulge. And then when the war ended, he was in charge of the military police during the Nuremberg, you know, war trials for the Nazi convicts. And then, there's just a whole group of them that did some exciting things before they even got into football. I remember one guy told me, he goes, you know, this is the guy that got scrapnel in his back. He said, football was easy. Football was easy compared to what we went through. None of us really thought football was, you know, hard. It was just fun after what we went through. And they were right. It was just a game to come home to. And they were happy to get paid.
Yeah, I mean, how great it must have been, you know, imagine if you're like a 12, 13, 14-year-old boy in the area. And, you know, you're, the guys are all coming home from war. So they're war heroes. You've been reading about them in the paper. You're everybody's having parades for them. It's, you know, it's a happy time in the United States after, you know, 4 or 5 years of misery and being scared, quite frankly, and rations and everything else. And then you get to see your heroes from the war going out on the football field and playing a game you love to watch. I mean, that had to be tremendous, an experience that I don't think we get to see in modern day very much, you know, but you have a whole team of them out there. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. There are definitely a group of heroes, you know, in both realms, sports and, you know, plus they were war heroes. So yeah, I would have liked to have been there just to see that, you know, just to see what it was like with those early days at Kezar Stadium. Kezar Stadium was kind of a crazy place too, but yeah, it must have been exciting.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned Kezar a couple of times, and I know you're very familiar with it. Why don't you tell us a little bit what Kezar Stadium was all about? Because it sounds like a very special place.
Well, I grew up close to Kezar Stadium. Kezar Stadium was built like in the mid 20s. So it was, I don't even know how to describe it. Think of the LA Coliseum, but without any amenities. It was just this big oval type of concrete and stucco building. Most of the seating was actually in the end zones. You know, there was hardly anything on the, you know, between the 30 yard lines, because they had concession stands and people. So all the major part of the seating was up high in the end zones. It was, let's see, there was very few parking spots. There was, you know, it was inner city, totally inner city place. It was right off Haight Street. If you went through, in fact, that's another story later on in the 60s. The players will tell you about Haight Street and everything, coming down Haight Street to go to the stadium. But so it's right off Haight Street and next to Golden Gate Park. And then on the other side of it's a big neighborhood. So there's no parking. There's maybe for 150 people, they could, you know, get in some of the players and the coaches and, you know, VIPs for parking spots. But everybody else, they just parked along the street. There was bars all along there. So people stopped and got some drinks before they show up at the bar or at the stadium. And inside the stadium itself, I mean, it was pretty rustic. There's the size of like the locker room. I'd been in the locker room a number of times because they use it for high school games. So I'd been in the locker room. It was still the same from like the 40s and 50s. No real lockers. All you had was like a nail on the wall where you could put your coat. And I don't see how they got 40 of these big guys in there. I mean, it was like today a bathroom in a stadium, you know?
Kezar Stadium still standing today?
They tore down the original one. It held like 60,000 people. And up until that was about 89, 90. It was used for high school and college games. And then they tore it down and now it's a 10,000 seat stadium and it's still used for high school games and soccer and lacrosse and stuff like that. Mostly high school stuff.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
It's still fun. It gives you shivers. I go back there and they still have the tunnel that you run out and, you know, I got my nephews play or some friends will play and I go, hey, I ran through that tunnel too, you know? So that the tunnel itself was a trip because you came out of the locker room and it didn't connect to the stadium. You had to walk into the parking lot, go down these stairs that went underneath the parking area. It was a big tunnel that went into the stadium. And when you went through the tunnel, there was it was just dirt. So Bob St. Clair used to tell a story. If you remember Bob St. Clair, he played in the 50s for the 49ers. He's in the Hall of Fame. But he would tell his teammates that we'll take the field first, kick up as much dust as you can so that when our opponent comes in, they'll be all choked up and coughing on the dust, you know. So there was a little gamesmanship, even, you know, taking the field through that little tunnel. Oh, so I remembered that. So when I told my nephews when they were playing there, kick up the dust. So you know, you get get the opponent a little bit winded before he even gets out there.
So both the visiting team and home team both use the same tunnel to get from the locker rooms to the parking lot. Wow. Okay. Yeah. That's really different. That's unique. I'm a former official, and I know that was always one of, for high school level, that's always one of our things. Never let the teams come in from the same area. Try to, if you can get them from opposite end zones, if you can, whatever is possible.
Yeah.
You never want them to cross paths, but that's interesting. So
there's only one way in and one way out. So everybody had to go, all the players had to go through that little tunnel.
I'm just envisioning beer showers and everything for the visitors coming off of there, but from the fans.
That was a major problem later on when I was old enough to actually start going there, like in the 60s. These were Dave John Brody and Ken Willard, Dave Wilcox, and those guys. And John Brody, for some reason, even though I think he was a great quarterback, when anything bad happened, he was blamed. And so he was constantly pummeled with bottles. And the seating in Kezar Stadium was just like wood seating, with no backs. And so they rented out these cushions that you could sit on because you would get splinters in your butt. So after the game, people would throw all their either bottles or they throw the seat cushions down at John Brody. Finally, they had to put in a big wire net kind of fence. So you kind of kept out some of the garbage, but it's still, if you're able to throw something as far as a 10 or 20 yard, like it still hit them.
So somewhere there's like the fans in Philadelphia are saying, see, we're not so bad. interesting.
It was pretty crazy. I remember they at Kezar Stadium, they had what was called Christopher Milk seats. Christopher Milk, George Christopher was the mayor, and he also had a dairy. And so you could cut out, buy a thing of, a quart of milk for a quarter, and you just cut out the little coupon on the side of it. So we get together with a bunch of guys, and we just go buy a bunch of milk and pour it out, tear off the coupon. That's what we get in for 25 cents. And then, but in the Christopher Milk section was supposed to be for kids 15 and under. And there was like no security. They'd have guys that were 35 years old in there smoking cigarettes, drinking half pints, swearing like crazy. And I'm like a 13-year-old Catholic school kid. I'm like, oh my God, where are we? This is bad.
every mother in the San Francisco Bay Area's nightmare is their kid going to that with their milk money.
Everybody I knew that grew up here has great memories of it. It was pretty fun. It was pretty eye-opening, that's for sure.
Hey, it probably was scary at the time, but it's a great story now, some many years later. So that's great.
Yeah, it was fun.
So when did the 49ers stop playing at Kezar Stadium and go to Candlestick, I'm assuming?
Yeah, the last season was 1970, and then they moved into Candlestick for the 71 season. And 1970, the last game was kind of like the highlight of the whole stadium's career, because that's when the 49ers played the NFC Championship against the Dallas Cowboys in 1970 there. It was the last game ever played there. And they lost. It was kind of a brutal loss. They looked like they might win, but they blew it in the fourth quarter. But that was the last game there, 1970. Then, yes, so 71 was the first season there, and then they left Candlestick in 2013.
So that's if I'm counting right, that's a good, from 1920 it's built. So it had, 30, 40 years of pro football played in it, plus all the college and high school games before and after that. So that's a good long run for a stadium, that's for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And it showed its wear too, I'll tell you. It was pretty, like I was saying, the worst thing was sitting on the bench seats. Your back would hurt. They had, apparently, from what I read later, is each person had 15 inches on the bench seating. And I guess people were a little skinnier back then. I don't think you could fit, 60,000 people in there on 15-inch seats like they did, then. But it was just so uncomfortable. You'd get splinters and people in front of you, your knees were in their back. It was bad seating, that's for sure.
I got You're making me draw memories, and it must have been that era, because I got an opportunity probably about 10 years ago to get a tour of the Yale Bowl, you know, off season, of course, but I got to go almost everywhere in the Yale Bowl, and it was just such a great thing. But one thing that really shocked me, I mean, I knew it was an oval and everything, but when I got there, I'm like looking for it, and it's like half buried in the ground. The field is way below ground level. They like dug a pit out and then put the stadium in there. So the top seats are probably only probably 20 feet off the ground level, I would say, you know, but when you're in a stadium, it looks like, you know, you're much higher. And that's what you almost got me picturing here. And there was wooden seats at the time. And I'm sure they were redoing it shortly after I was through there.
Yeah.
So
sounds very, very similar. I don't think it was even, you know, on the outsides, it was maybe three stories high. And the neighbors would, like in Wrigley Field, the neighbors would sit on their roofs, and they had the best seats. They were looking down on the field, you know? So there's a little bit higher in the end zone because you had the scoreboard and stuff there. But it was pretty small. Yet when I look back on it, I'm thinking maybe there was 100 or 150 rows of seats. It wasn't that big. There was no like tiered seating up above, you know, where you can look down. No boxes, obviously. The only box, well, if you want to call it that, they had a press box. But the press box was kind of a joke. The press used to always complain because it was always like the mayor and his friends, and they're up there drinking and cheering, which you're not supposed to do in the press box, right? So it wasn't really the for the media. It was for VIPs.
And they probably weren't drinking the mayor's milk, I'm assuming, either at that time.
No, right? No. It wasn't Christopher milk. Yeah.
Well, okay. I mean, Kazar sounds like a great, great place to, you know, just a fantastic, nostalgic, vintage place to watch a game. So let's get back into, now you started telling us about the first season of the 49ers and, you know, how they were in the AFC. And I know before we came on, you talked particular about one of the second or third season where the 49ers really had a great year. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, well, in 1946, the first year, they had their backfield was Frankie Albert was the quarterback. Len Ashmont was one of the running backs. Norm Stanley, who was from Stanford. So both Stanley and Frankie Albert were from Stanford. So they were well-known in the Bay Area. They were kind of a drawing card. And then they were still on the team in 1948. In 1948, they had an unbelievable offense. The running back, same guys. It was Frankie Albert, Len Ashmont, Norm Stanley, and another guy named Johnny Strykowski. They averaged, this is an average now, 262 yards rushing per game as a team.
Wow.
260 yards per game over a 14-game season. Jeez. And 6.2 yards per carry. So you think, okay, man, somebody must have gained 1,000 yards in there. Nobody gained 1,000 yards. One guy, Strykowski, had 900, but they had seven guys that had over like 208, almost 300 yards and above. It was just like a running machine. Joe Perry came in that year also. That was his rookie season. Joe Perry, of course, went on the Hall of Fame, was one of the greatest running backs, but he wasn't a starter even. He was like someone who just came, he was trying to pick up the offense. He hadn't played in college. He was one of those guys you're talking about that was noticed playing for one of the local military teams. And in fact, one of those 49er teammates later is the guy that discovered him. He came back and told Buckshaw, you got to take a look at this guy. So then they get Joe Perry in there, which add a little more speed to the backfield. And yeah, so the offense, the running game was incredible. And then Frankie Albert, who was also a scrambler. So he gained himself about 400 yards rushing, but he also threw for 29 touchdowns and 2,500 yards, which was a lot back then.
That's two touchdown passes a game, you know?
Yeah. And their main receiver was a guy named Alan Beals, who had 14 touchdown passes, which was a team record up until Jerry Rice came along. In fact, Alan Beals, when the AFC folded, he led the league in scoring. He had incredible touchdown percentage from his catches to touchdowns. Something like 20% of his catches went for touchdowns.
Wow. So that his record stood almost four decades, really, till Rice was in his prime, you know, right?
Yeah.
Talking mid, late 80s. Wow, that's fantastic. Those aren't
really recognized by the NFL. The AFC records aren't in the NFL's Hall of Fame stuff, you know. So, like Joe Perry, I talked to some of his family once in a while, and Joe Perry gained, well, he's still in the Hall of Fame, but he gained about another 2,000 yards in the All-America Football Conference. So if you added up his 9,000 in the NFL, 2,000 in the All-America Football Conference, he'd be like in the top 10 somewhere, you know?
Yeah, 11,000, 12,000 yards. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's
so sad. It's kind of sad they didn't include those extra yards for all those guys, you know?
Yeah, maybe someday they'll be able to do that. And because I know they've included the AFC or the AFL. I mean, when the AFL merged, you'd think the AFC, and I know people are still, you know, wanting the USFL and everything else too. But I think the AFC really has some good merit, you know, the AFL did. So many acronyms going on here. I'm getting confused, getting tongue-tied. They had a really potent offense, and you're saying 260 yards of rushing game, a game, and two touchdown passes averaging, but it wasn't against cream puff defenses. They played in the AAFC West that, if I'm not mistaken, you know, the LA Dons were pretty good most of those years. Cleveland Browns were, you know, the team, you know, and who else was in that in the West there with them for the fourth team?
The Dons, and did Chicago have a team?
Oh yeah, Chicago Rockets would have been the other one.
Rockets. Yeah.
Chicago, okay. Rockets. Yeah, that was where they got a lot of the yardage on.
So. Yeah, yeah, they averaged over 35 yards per game. I mean, 35 points per game. So wow. You look at the old scores, like 57-14 or something. There's a lot of high scoring games there. I think that was kind of what the league was like anyway. There was a lot of scoring, more scoring than defense.
Yeah, 35 points a game. That's got to be right up there in the top five of all time for a team. Wow. Yeah, I mean, in any league.
Well, the 261 yards per game, 260 yards per game, that's in the top two or three of all time rushing, even now with the current NFL.
Yeah, so. I believe,
you know, counted.
that's tremendous. That's a high-powered offense for sure. So yeah. So how was the other side of the ball? How did they play on defense?
Well, the defense wasn't all that great. Like I was saying, they gave up almost as many points as they scored themselves. But that's the time when everybody was going both ways. Almost all the players would switch from, you know, their offensive position to defense. And then there was a few that subbed in, but almost everybody went both ways. So I'm imagining they were probably exhausted, you know. By the time the fourth quarter's rolling around. And then there's guys like, Leo Nomalini, he was a little bit later. He didn't come into like 1950, but he played 60 minutes for 5 years before they finally said, let's just put you on defense. He was all pro as an offensive tackle and all pro as a defensive tackle. And I knew him pretty well. He was a kind of a character around our area. You'd always see him like church or whatever at the grocery store. He talked to everybody, but he would talk about, I played on, you know, field goal team and the punt team and every team. He never even came out for special teams, but apparently he loved it. So, and he played 14 season. He was like a total Iron Man. That's for sure.
Jeez, I can't even imagine, you know, if you're single platoon and you're scoring 35 points a game on offense and all that rushing yards, you're up and down the field. And then, you know, you go to get a drink of water and the coach, hey, get back out there and play defense. What are you doing? You're gassed, I'm sure.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Wow. Wow. That's some real Iron Men, like you said. That's tremendous. Yeah. So, okay. So they had, how did they end up doing in the AAFC those years?
They finished second to Cleveland every year.
Every year. Wow.
Their I think they beat the, they played them twice a year. I think there was one year, they, last year, 49, they beat, they put up a score like 56 to 17. They smoked them. But then Cleveland beat them in the NFC or the AFC championship game. So it was kind of a letdown. And yeah, that was the last game of the AFC. It folded right after the game.
But hey, that Paul Brown, you get him once, but it's hard to get him a second time. He's a very clever individual.
That was a great team. I looked up one time that there was a game between the Browns and the 49ers where on the field there was 10 or 11 future Hall of Famers between the two teams.
Wow.
The Browns were loaded. I mean, obviously the coach, Paul Brown, he's in the Hall of Famer too. But yeah, they were loaded with, both teams were loaded with great players.
And it's even more special because they weren't even NFL at that point in time. You know, really special when you're talking about that. Like we just said earlier, you know, the Pro Football Hall of Fame doesn't always recognize these ulterior leagues that are not the NFL to come into their halls, you know? So that's great. To hear
the
that
Browns, when the Browns slipped into the 49ers and the Browns went back into the NFL in 1950 and the Browns dominated the NFL, their first couple teams, 50, 51, 50, they were NFC champ or NFL champions. They were good. Marion Motley and, you know, Otto Graham and all those guys. That was a formidable group. Definitely.
Yeah. We're going to be talking about them with George Bozica here in about a week or so. So we'll be hearing a lot about them in our tour through the AAFC. So
Yeah.
So how did the 49ers? Okay, so they had second place every year, and you know the NFL must have saw something in them that chose them to be one of the three teams that the NFL would, I guess you'd call, absorb into the NFL for the 1950 season. And what do you think some of those characteristics are that they saw in the Niners?
Well, I think that they became, because of their offense, pretty much, you know, people liked offense. They could see a lot of scoring and passing. 49ers with Buck Shaw was a passing kind of, even though they had a great running game, he was more inclined to pass. And then later on, you see he went to the NFL and he won in a championship with the Philadelphia Eagles. The same thing, you like to pass, but so maybe I was in, I mean, a more wide open way of playing. You get a lot of scoring involved. The Browns were the same way. I mean, the Browns were a cinch to get into the NFL. I mean, that was such a good team. And for the 49ers, I think they might have wanted to come west. You know, the Rams were coming, were, you know, starting to make a name for themselves. So it was just like a good time to, hey, let's get another West Coast team in and we can open up the country to more football.
And they must have had a good following, you know, all the kids buying milk and cutting out the cartons and you know, the mayor, you know, having a smoke and a drink up in the press box and cheering a team on, you know,
yeah,
60,000 strong at Kazar Stadium. You know, they must have liked that.
That was a pretty rowdy crowd. That's my dad was a cop at that time. And he would tell me about how sometimes he had to do duty at Kazar Stadium and he hated it because he said everybody was drunk and fighting by the ends of the game. So yeah, that's how it was. It was just a completely different time. It was, well, going back to it being a neighborhood operation, I mean, all the people that were working at the gates were guys we knew from the neighborhood. They were a coach or a teacher or someone from church that you knew. And so they'd let people just walk in with cases of beer and, you know, a pint of whiskey or whatever. There was no security at all. So that's the way it was back then. It was a completely different, you know, way of looking at football. Now, you know, that would never go. I mean, you go through all this security now, but
yeah, metal detectors and dog dishes and everything else. You have to put your keys in just to get in there.
Yeah.
I don't think they let you carry a case of beer and they did in those days. Wow. That's funny. That's amazing how much things have changed and you know, that must've been a great party atmosphere and there's a laid back thing and it makes the players feel more comfortable and, you know, want to play for that kind of crowd too. There's a lot of loyalty and everything that, I'm sure. Definitely.
The 49ers, they were really loyal fans. That's what, you know, most of the players who I talked to, they loved the fans. They were real loyal. But if you know, you did something like John Brody threw an interception in the last minute, you'd hear about it, you know, cushions would be coming down at you. But I mean, then outside of the stadium there, like I mentioned earlier, that there was bars all up and down Haight Street. And then, you know, all around the stadium, and people would, you know, cause there was no parking, they had to walk a long way, stop and get a beer or two before they came into the stadium. And then afterwards, there's, you know, big party. In fact, there's still one bar that's still there right across from Kezar. It used to be called the Kezar Club when the 49ers play there, but they changed the name when they bought it to the Kezar Pub. I guess they had to change the name, but still inside the Kezar Club, they have all sorts of old pictures of the 49ers and the games back at Kezar Stadium from that time. So if you're ever in San Francisco, come on out, and it's right off of Haight Street. And there it is, Haight and Stanion.
That sounds great. I got to make a trip out there sometime because that's on the bucket list, especially to go see a Niners game. But that's a good segue into this. So let's say I'm a tourist and I'm going to go to Levi Stadium for the first time, and I'm going to go to the museum that you helped curate. What is Joe Hession's, one of his crowning pieces that you would point me to go and see at the 49ers museum?
Well, the crowning piece, my favorite piece, is the ball that Dwight Clark caught for the catch. That's in a kind of a special place where you kind of walk in. When you walk in first, you see a film. The film's kind of like a spine tingler, you know, like, you know, you got that voice from the guy from NFL Films.
John Facenda.
Yeah. The great music. And it just, by the time you're out, you're ready to run through the wall by the time it's over. And then you go through the, there's a big gallery, the Hall of Fame gallery, with life-size replicas, statues of every one in the Hall of Fame. There's, I think now there's 27. We add somebody every year. Bryant Young was the last guy to just get in this year. And then John Taylor. And then you come around and then you see the ball. And I have a story about that too, by the way. The guy who had the ball was a good friend of mine. And it was not known who really had the ball. This is Dwight Clark's The Catch. They had to go back through NFL Films. They tracked where the ball was spiked, who picked it up, where it was handed to. And we finally figured out that my friend, Bill McDonough, was the guy who had the ball. He always claimed he had it because he worked on the sidelines for NFL Films. And he always claimed that he had it, but Dwight Clark said he had it. And so this was kind of a sticky point because they both of them, you know, Bill didn't want to ruffle Dwight Clark's feathers and say, no, Dwight, you're wrong. So it wasn't until, you know, later on when Dwight was kind of ill and we were getting ready to put the 49ers final touches in, that we approached Dwight and told him, you know, this isn't the right ball, Dwight. And we told him about the thing and he says, ah, shucks. I had it in my closet all that time. So he was pretty nice about it, but that's how Dwight Clark was. And then, so Bill's ball's in there and his spotlight's on it. And cause that's the kind of that was the play that kind of launched the franchise into their championship years, you know. Well, that's a thing that everybody remembers about the 49ers is the catch, you know.
I'm a Steelers fan, you know, I'm in Western Pennsylvania, and I guess you would have to compare that to like the Immaculate Reception ball, which that one, they have, that's a private owner and it's like in a bank vault and, you know, high security and everything, you can't even see it. I know there's been a couple TV personalities that got in and got to see it and some things. I think like Peyton Manning's show had it on once, but that's amazing how that one play can just like turn a franchise around that's, you know, somewhat of a perennial loser and propel them into a dynasty. And it's that one moment, you know, that really to the 49ers and the Steelers both definitely have that one moment. It's very special.
Yeah, that was definitely a change in the franchise's momentum with that catch. And, you know, Dwight Clark was everywhere he went, people would ask him about it. He never tired of talking about it. He loved it. He loved it. You know, a lot of guys would probably go, okay, I'm tired of talking about this, but he was just the nicest guy, man. And he would talk to anybody, you know, and everybody was like his friend. You were always, you could go up to him and just meet him for the first time. And he would remember your name and you were his friend and all that. He was a beauty. He was the greatest.
And can you imagine what Dwight Clark had to go, or Joe Montana? You know, those are the things that you dream about when you're, you know, a 10-year-old kid in the backyard by yourself and throwing the ball to yourself and, you know, talking like you're the announcer, you know, last play of the game, it's all on the line, you know, throws to the end zone. And Dwight Clark and Montana live that, you know, you know, tenfold, you know, it was just an exciting play just the whole way around. Just one of those great plays in football history. So,
Dwight heard it from a lot of his teammates. Nobody thought he could jump that high. They would always kid him about, how'd you get up that high, Dwight? They never thought he could get up that high to catch it. And then Joe Montana used to always say they should call it the throw, it was my throw, not your catch. But I mean, they were great friends. It was just like a big joke between them, you know.
Very interesting. Well, Joe, I appreciate you coming on here, telling us about the origins of the 49ers and the AAFC, and, you know, talking a little bit of history. I'd love to have you on again and talk about, you know, some of those great 80s teams, like we're talking about, getting them a little bit more detail here in a future episode, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, sure. I'd love to.
Okay. Well, Joe Heschen, thank you very much for talking about the 49ers and spending some time with us here. And, you're welcome anytime back on the Pigpen, and we'll send an invite out to you real soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Darren. It was a pleasure to be on with you. Take care.
Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast.
We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. A special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, it's found right here on the Sports History Network.